Oh my god, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. Alright, Lisa, how are you ready for this?
Cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us. Nobody
told me that these days like this. Suddenly, something else flew into the frame, fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, and welcome to edition 437 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. This week, the last in April 2007, a special with weekly editorial contributor Dave Ferlot and former UFO investigator, former director of investigation for UFO magazine, Don Ecker, who last week announced he was quitting ufology. We'll spend some 90 minutes with Don reminiscing over his 20 years of UFOs and discussing what he has found fault with in the field. But first, the big story out of Europe this week has been the sighting of a UFO around the Channel Islands off the British coast. The commercial TV station on the islands, Channel TV, interviewed one of the pilots, Captain Ray Barrier, earlier this week, and here's some of that interview.
On Monday afternoon, Captain Ray Barrier was piloting a routine passenger flight from Southampton to Alderney, but to his and the passengers' surprise, a strange object became visible on the horizon.
You've been a professional pilot for 20 years. You've flown thousands of flights. You're putting your reputation on the line here, so you must truly believe what you saw was very real.
In my years of experience, I've never seen anything like this. And frankly, I'd be perfectly happy not to ever again. It's a pretty chilling thing. And from my first sighting of it, which was initially maybe around 50 miles away, perhaps 40 miles away from the actual object, it appeared to be fairly small, but it must have been pretty huge. It must have been very, very much larger than I thought it was originally. I told air traffic control that they asked me for a size, approximately. I said about the size of a 737, perhaps twice the size. But in reflection, seeing this object from about 40 miles away, it must have been very, very much bigger than that. Perhaps, maybe a mile across, perhaps.
Were you scared?
I wasn't too happy, put it that way. I was quite glad to get on the ground and have a cup of tea.
So this appeared as a solid object?
Well, getting closer to it, through binoculars I could see a sort of a shape, extremely pointed, very long and thin, and this area, about two-thirds of the way along the fuselage, was pretty dark. This was very brilliant yellow, very golden yellow.
Now what's particularly interesting about this case is that not only did you see it, but your passengers saw it, and indeed radar picked it up. Can you tell me about that?
As I understand it, there was a plot taken on the Jersey radar to be a couple of miles south of the Caskets Lighthouse, and another aircraft also flying in the vicinity from the Isle of Man into Guernsey, I believe, saw a similar sort of thing.
Jersey Air Traffic Control confirmed their radar picked up some activity in the area, but say the data can't be taken as evidence of the UFO's presence.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Ferlot.
After 20 years of doing some very serious research into the field of ufology, Don Ecker has decided to say enough is enough and bow out of the field. This is not because he has found the smoking gun or because he has decided there is nothing to UFOs and little green or gray men. It's because he's tired of the bullshit that is associated with the field. If one looks over the contributions made to ufology by Don Ecker over the past two decades, it reads like a who's who of everyone that has ever been involved in the search for the truth about UFOs and extraterrestrial visitors. He's been to the places where sightings have taken place. He's gathered witness testimony. He's interviewed many people for his radio show and his magazine. He's given many presentations to various groups all over North America, and he has exposed a number of individuals that were trying to pull fast ones on the ufological community. I personally will miss Don Ecker, although he and I have never met or spoken together, because I happen to agree with almost everything he has ever said or believed about UFOs and what's going on around us. In many ways, I also have sometimes thought that perhaps I and many other much more noteworthy individuals involved in ufology should give it up too, because I believe, much like Don Ecker, that there is too much bullshit floating around. Like Don, I'm totally amazed that when frauds are exposed or hoaxes are uncovered, that a number of people still remain firmly convinced that the person or event is the real thing. Sometimes the events just seem to submerge for a brief period of time until most people forget about them, and they suddenly surface somewhere else, bringing in a whole new group of believers. When the old evidence is brought out again, many of the new people just calmly state that it's all some disinformation conspiracy and plunk down their $50, $100, or more to help keep the supposed truth out there. The problem with all of this is that there really is some kind of disinformation being spread around by government and intelligence agencies. And when that disinformation is discovered and placed under a microscope, the question has to become one of, why would a group like the CIA or some other intelligence agency bother to involve themselves with something that, well, officially does not exist? One of the reasons that Don is quitting his involvement with ufology is that new people coming into the field appear to not deem it worthwhile to do their homework. They don't bother checking out a lot of the work done over the decades by hundreds of people, and instead they latch onto something and suddenly make it seem as though they were the ones to discover this great new thing. Whereas if they had bothered to do a little digging, perhaps they might have come across a book or two written on the very thing they feel they've discovered. Don is also very disenchanted with the infighting that goes on within ufology, because one group will believe in one thing and will lower themselves to do ad hominem attacks on someone to try and make themselves seem more important. In a way, I suppose I'm a little guilty of that, because there are a few people like James Oberg that I like to take shots at occasionally. But honestly, it's not to try and make myself ever seem important. I consider myself to be a very small little cog in the machinery of ufology, and doubt if my name will ever be on the tip of anyone's tongue when speaking about this field. The truth be known, I sometimes feel as though all the efforts of myself and others within this field are futile. However, I'm not ready to give it up yet, because I really want to know the truth behind UFOs. I want to know what they are. I want to know where they come from, who it is that's behind the wheel, and why they are so interested in us. Although it scares the hell out of me to imagine why, I also want to know why the governments of some of the countries on this planet believe it is necessary to continue with a global conspiracy and cover-up of the reality of UFOs. But that's just my take on it. And Don, you will be missed.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to talking to Don Ecker and digging down there and getting some names and some places that really he feels are not conducive to this field.
Yeah, they'll probably be very familiar to all of us. It'll be one of those situations where he'll be talking about a lot of the things that have surfaced and submerged in this field over and over and over.
Yes, it's really unfortunate that Don has decided to quit.
It's a big loss for us,
mm-hmm.
A very, very big loss, because his effort, it's incredible. It is mind-blowing to think that he has invested so much time and energy in the field of ufology, and now he's just basically saying, well, I give up. And it's basically what he's doing. He's giving up, but I think he's giving up just sheerly out of frustration.
Undoubtedly, that's what it is. I read the document that he put out, the PDF file, which, mm-hmm. for the listeners, by the way, is linked in this week's program listing. As you said in your take, it's like a who's who this man has spent time with in the last 20 years. It's really quite remarkable.
Oh, it blows my mind, some of the people that he has actually sat down and had a drink with and gotten into their heads and pulled out some information. And some of the people that he's tracked down blew my mind simply because I'd never heard of them, but all of a sudden it's like, oh my God. You know, this is one of the serious people that really should be brought forward a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Like yourself, I went and read the same PDF, and it's just, whoa.
Yeah, some really interesting pictures in there, which just adds to the weight of the people that he's been involved with. I'm really looking forward to talking to him.
I'm going to be looking very, very forward to listening to all of that as well.
Yeah. Well, you know where it lives, Dave. Go help yourself.
I shall. Not to worry.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you next week.
For sure.
Dave Furlott, always with us, regular weekly contributor, has been virtually from the outset, and he and I have been doing this program together for 8 years, basically nonstop. And look forward to another 8 years. When Stuart Miller was on the last SDI, he absolutely blew me away when he broke the news that our next guest was quitting ufology. He was leaving the field. He'd become frustrated with all the idiocy, the stupidity, the shysters, and the hoaxers involved in the field. And when you consider who our next guest is and how much time and energy he has put into UFO research as the director of research for UFO Magazine, and before that as an independent before he married one of the founders of UFO Magazine, Vicky Cooper, Don Ecker has just, I guess, when you read the file that is linked in this week's program listing, the PDF file, and go through it, it's full of pictures, it's full of anecdotes. When you read that, you kind of understand why he had to just throw his hands up and say, the hell with it, I've had enough. And I thought, oh my God, this man is going to disappear and not want to talk to anybody ever again about UFOs. So I'm grateful that you're with us.
My pleasure, absolutely.
For the people who haven't read this 20 years in the UFO fog, it's an amazing biography. You have done so much work, so much credible work. You have discredited so many people who needed to be discredited. You have worked with all of the well-respected people in the field, most of whom are still working in the field. Do you find that amazing?
Well, yeah. And, you know, it's funny. Going back over 20 years ago when I first became involved in this and made a conscious decision to become involved in it, you might say I was naive, even though, I mean, I had, by that time, I had been a police officer, a criminal investigator with over 10 years on the job. I had been a two-tour Southeast Asian veteran of the Army, the United States Army. I had been wounded twice. I had been married and had lost a child to an illness. And subsequently, my wife then and I ended up divorcing, which is one of those unfortunate things that often happen when one loses a child. But I say I was naive because I went into this looking at a lot of these experts, and I'm putting that in parentheses, and I did not yet realize that so many of them had personal agendas that, in my opinion, later colored the research that they were presenting to the public. My idea of a genuine in-depth investigation involved talking about warts and all, if one found warts. And in the field of UFOs, I mean, it's such a difficult subject anyway, because quite honestly, Earl, there is so much crap around the subject. And a lot of that crap is intentional, and a lot of the crap is, quite frankly, put there by people who don't know any better. So, yeah, it was quite an eye-opener for me.
It's amazing how people tend to flock to the crap.
Well, yeah, and this is true often in many endeavors with things with human participation. When it comes to something as esoteric as the UFO phenomenon, now let's be real clear and let me be very upfront. I think that there is absolutely a genuineness. There is something, probably, most likely, a very far advanced technological phenomenon here that we don't yet understand or have a firm handle on. So if somebody asks me, Ecker, do you think that the UFO phenomenon, that there is a genuine phenomenon there? Absolutely, yes. I personally had a quite amazing experience with the UFO phenomenon back in 1966. But with that aside, there are people out there that simply want to believe. Now, a very good case in point, what I'm talking about. Many years ago, back in the early 1990s, my wife Vicki and I had received a telephone call from somebody who was then a new name in the field, a fellow by the name of Dr. Stephen Greer. Now, Greer today, of course, is known for his CSETI organization, but he wanted to meet with us. He wanted to have lunch and sit down and discuss UFOs. So we said, sure, fine, you bet. We picked a restaurant, met him there. And right off the bat, Dr. Greer began talking about how his belief structure encompassed the idea that UFOs were at worst totally benign, and at very best they were here to, in essence, save us from ourselves.
Hmm.
Now, in my paper, and I state in there very clearly that when I first made a conscious decision to become involved in this field, I conducted, for my own personal reasons, an intensive, almost six-month study on what this subject encompassed. And I'm talking about back in 1987-88. I haunted bookstores. I haunted the library. I went to used bookstores. And I have a rather extensive collection of UFO works that I've accumulated over the years. And I read them all. I made my own decisions. And although a case cannot definitively be made that UFOs are either hostile or benign, one can certainly not say that they are here strictly to enhance the human condition. There have been too many cases over the years where people have been injured, have been killed, have disappeared, aircraft had come down. Now, regardless of whether one could argue whether it was a military action or something, but hey, a lot of people have lost their lives and have been injured in the 60-plus years of the modern UFO age. So I became rather forceful in retrospect with Greer. And I said, look, nobody can make that assumption that they're here for our benefit. There's just not enough evidence yet. And as it turned out, Earl, that was the very last time that I ever had any contact with Greer. He wanted nothing more to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later, we, in fact, did have contact with his SETI organization. And unfortunately, in my opinion, so many of those people are cultish-like. They just follow this guy, and I believe there is a very great lack of critical thinking. But that can be said about a lot of cases. But that's the type of blind following somebody that is taking them down the garden path. I have a problem with that.
I was turned off Greer, and I never met him. I talked to him on the radio for a few minutes, but I was turned off by the way, and there are people whom I respect in this field who deny that that's actually what happened, but I was turned off by Greer when he took the Center for UFO Studies research work into UFOs and basically presented them as his own.
Greer was something else that kind of turned me off. And I don't want anybody to think that I'm just picking on Greer. There are a lot of people out there that deserve to be scrutinized, but I can recall him taking gangs of folks out into the boondocks and flashing flashlights and searchlights into the sky and wishing UFOs to come down and, for God's sake, handing out boarding passes and everybody recording a last statement to their family and friends in the event that a UFO came down and picked them up. Now, you got to admit, and this ran on a straight media news broadcast, mm-hmm. I think, if I recall, it was CBS that did this, and it did irreparable harm to the entire field.
Yes.
So that kind of stuff will never make the straight mainstream science sit up and look at this subject critically, which is something that we tried to do over the years with a number of what I thought were quite good cases that should have been examined by the mainstream. But the mainstream will never touch this subject for a number of reasons, not the least of which is organizations like CSETI and other organizations in the past like the George Adamskys, the Heaven's Gate people. These just absolutely smeared overall UFO research.
And in the way that exopolitics has in the last few years.
Well, there's another case. Now, a number of years ago when the Hale-Bopp comet broke, and I talk about that in my paper, the genesis of the Hale-Bopp fiasco with radio personality Art Bell. A lot of people may not recall this, but you see, that's one of the things I guess I've been kind of an ad hoc historian about at least my 20 years in this field. And I remember that Art had on during this period of time, you know, and here it's going to sound like I'm picking on Greer again, but he had Greer on. And Greer was talking about he was going to Washington, was going to have a big press conference, and here are some of the UFO whistleblowers that he's going to have presenting their evidence. And lo and behold, one of those initially was a guy by the name of Guy Kirkwood, also known as Mel Noel, also known as Noel Bryce Cornwall. A guy that had been in the periphery of UFOs going back 40 years, a guy that was a proven hoaxer, a scamster, claimed that he was an Air Force pursuit pilot, had never served in the Air Force, even made it into Timothy Good's first book, Above Top Secret. This guy had been exposed. here in Los Angeles back in the 60s as a scamster. I did a major expose on him in 1992, and Greer didn't even have the wherewithal to do any examination on these people prior to announcing that they were going to be going to Washington to hopefully testify before Congress. Now, that's unconscionable. And this is the slipshod research, if I can be so bold, that unfortunately so many people in this field just don't seem to do any better than that.
And, of course, there were one or two others in that panel of speakers at the Washington Press Club back in, 2002, who were very questionable.
Well, I can remember one of Greer's spokespeople, a woman by the name of Carol Rosen, who waxed so eloquently about, among other people, Wernher von Braun, who is, I guess many people consider one of the fathers of the American space program. And I had a problem with that because Rosen was Jewish. Von Braun had been an SS colonel in the German Reich and had utilized slave labor. Now, granted, he definitely, beyond any shadow of a doubt, helped America get to the moon. But let's not forget what this guy's background was. And he was telling her about the dangers of militarizing space. And I could go on an entire show just about that. But in my opinion, these people didn't have a clue, nor could they buy a vowel, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this was shocking to me.
Did you ever have the opportunity to talk to Daniel Sheehan?
Oh, Danny Sheehan, sure. Yeah, we talked to him. He was somebody that had gone all the way back to the Carter administration. I mean, there's a ton that we could talk about concerning Jimmy Carter and his initial promise to release UFO information had he ever been elected president.
Yes.
But what about Sheehan?
Sheehan was on the program, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago and talked about Carter arranging for him to get into the Blue Book Archive when it was housed in the new facility. And Sheehan told us about finding photographs and various documents there. And, of course, he couldn't bring anything out, couldn't write notes, he couldn't do anything. And I was wondering if Sheehan had ever talked to you about it and how you felt about that story.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that story. Now, I must tell you that I have always, in my 20 years, tried to maintain an apolitical stance in my UFO investigations. And I called it as I saw it, whether it was a black eye at the government or a black eye at a witness, whatever the case may be, I called it as I saw it.
Yes.
Now, with people like Danny Sheehan, they have always put a very, very noticeable left-wing slant on anything having to do with this subject. Now, regardless whether it was a left-wing slant or a right-wing slant, still, it's a political slant. And I think before we can get into the politics of this, we first have to get into the legitimate facts and evidence surrounding this subject. That's simply my opinion, Earl.
That's the way it should be, and that should be the credo of every UFO investigator or every seriously interested civilian.
Well, I can recall back in 1992, along about the time when I broke on national TV down here in the States, the STS-48 video. Now, this involved an unknown object that was videotaped a live feed from the STS shuttle over Australia and New Zealand. Now, anybody that's interested in this field, I'm sure, have at least heard about this case. We all will remember that in 1992, there was a presidential election going on. George Bush Sr. and his running mate, Dan Quayle, was squaring up with William Clinton and Al Gore, and also Ross Perot was in the mix.
Yes.
And I had a call from Dick Hoagland, Richard Hoagland, another very well-known name in the field. And Hoagland had a genuine fear that he expressed to me that this STS video, in fact, was showing an American Department of Defense unmanned drone that was being test flown, and that there were secret Star Wars weapons being fired at this thing, all in preparation for the then sitting American president, George Bush Sr., to stage a fake alien invasion to steal the election from Clinton and or Perot. Now, I gotta tell you, man, I was blown away by that. But this is the danger of non-critical thinking. You know, there is such a thing as Occam's razor. And sometimes the simplest explanation, in fact, turns out to be the correct one. It was simply an unknown. Of course, now we'll never know. I debated Dr. Jim Oberg on Larry King Live about that. NASA at that time was trying to maintain that it was wastewater that the viewing public was actually witnessing from a shuttle dump, even though, I might add, and I have that entire tape of that mission, even though the wastewater dump had not yet happened. They were saying it was frozen urine, for God's sake, flying around in space. So, yeah, you know, there's so much crap with this subject. It really takes some patience to wade through it.
Yes, and that STS-48 footage was pretty astounding. And that object coming up through the clouds, through the atmosphere, followed by a flash of some kind. And then this thing seems to be coming almost toward the shuttle and then makes a sudden 90-degree turn left and out into the darkness of space.
Well, not only was there a flash, but then you can see something streaking at that UFO.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the UFO makes that dramatic 145-degree angle turn, at least quadrupling its speed and shooting out into space, and then circles back around. So, yeah, there was something extraordinarily unusual about that. Now, can we say that it was, beyond any doubt, an actual example of extraterrestrial technology? No, we can't. Now, if I were to go into court and they ask for my personal opinion, then I would say, you know what, I'm pretty sure that whatever that thing was, it was not built in Detroit.
Probably a more reasoned explanation than the ones that NASA have come out with on not just that occasion, but many occasions since, explaining anomalous objects in NASA video footage.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. Well, you know, the American government has a long and proud tradition of coming up with some of the most extraordinary explanations for some of these deeply troubling UFO cases. And that's only one. If you go back to the heyday of UFO research, and I consider that to be the time when Major Donald Keyhoe was in charge of NICAP, and you look at some of the cases that Keyhoe brought to the public, and immediately upon the heels of this case being examined by people like Keyhoe, the Air Force coming out with explanations like, oh, that was only the planet Venus as it was rising above the horizon. And then the experts would take a look, well, gee, where was Venus at? And it turns out it was on the opposite side of the planet. Then you have a problem. But those kind of explanations were routinely made. But very, very seldom did the same number of the public hear that that explanation could be patently ridiculous.
Let's go back to 1966, and you'd mentioned earlier on that you had an extraordinary experience back in 66. What was that?
I was in high school, in 1966, and I grew up in the state of Pennsylvania, in the central western part of the state. Now, in the month of December, back in those days, and it's been many years since I've been there, but the hunting season for deer was like Christmas, Easter, and Halloween all rolled up in one. And everybody that I knew just lived for the beginning of deer season. Now, generally in December, about that time of year, you would get a snowfall or a number of snowfalls. And the first day of high school that deer season premiered on, the day would be given to the students to take off because so many people hunted. And it was during that period of time, I was with three friends. We were up in an area of Pennsylvania around the Horseshoe Curve, which is a railroad construction that took place back in the 19th century. It was quite famous. And we were up in the hills hunting, had been hunting all day, and it was late in the afternoon, I guess about, sometime a little after 4 p.m., and we were coming down off the hill to get to our cars and go home. It was cold. I mean, you know, we'd been out there slugging around in the hills all day long. And as we were coming down the hill, one of my friends happened to look up in the sky behind us, and he shouted. Now, the first thing that crossed my mind is, oh, this dummy saw a deer, and he's going to scare it away. And all of us whipped around and looked and then looked up, and we saw, in a diamond formation, four brilliant lights. They weren't going real fast. I'm only estimating now, but it couldn't have been more than a couple of hundred miles an hour. And they were up about maybe 12, 15,000 feet. But once again, I'm speculating. And suddenly, as they're flying over the top of us, the light in the rear immediately shot straight up in the sky, just like a Natlas rocket taking off, if you can imagine that. And now, these three lights, which are in a V formation, since the rear light shot straight up in the sky, hit a burst of speed. They were still traveling in the same direction, and within seconds, they were out of sight. Now, I got to tell you, there were four young guys standing there with their jaw down around their kneecaps, and we couldn't believe that. So as soon as I got home, I immediately told my folks about it. I looked in the paper. There was no mention of it. And not too long after that was when the story broke on John Keel's investigation down in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, concerning the Mothman.
Mothman, yes.
Now, years later, when I was first becoming involved in the field, like I said, I had done a very in-depth historical search for information on this subject. And I got to tell you, I was astounded to discover all the cases that were in my neck of the woods at that time that were later reported that had never made the newspapers, the radio, or TV news broadcast. It was just astounding.
Mm.
That entire part of the United States, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, had literally been invaded by these things, UFOs, UFO cases, and even strange creature reports. And I got to tell you, it was an eye-opener that this type of information could be concealed for such a length of time.
The real researchers are still stumbling across reports from back in those days.
Example, you take Stan Gordon,
one of the
really good UFO investigators, has been for years studying the Kecksburg case, which took place in 1965. Which, incidentally, was only about, I'm guessing, 60 miles or so from my home. From where I used to live, you can be there in a little over an hour, hour and a half. Another one of those weird cases. However, I got to tell you, I am not totally convinced that this, whatever it was, could be explained by the ET explanation. I have in recent years considered that perhaps this might have actually been recovered Soviet Russian technology, a satellite or something. I don't know, but that explanation is still possible.
What gives me cause to wonder really hard is even if it were recovered Russian technology, there were many NASA personnel who were there, were seen by many witnesses, and NASA still does not want to release to the Coalition for Freedom of Information, Leslie Kane and various other people, including folks from the Sci-Fi Channel, still doesn't want to release documents that they have on that case.
Do you know why?
Why is that, Don?
Because if it were Soviet, we had signed treaties. The United States government had signed treaties with the Soviets back in those days about space. And had that been actually Soviet technology, then basically we were in violation of the treaty if we took that material and it was Russian and didn't give it back to them. Now remember, during this period of time, there was a tremendously unimaginable space race going on to get to the moon first. There, we're talking about literally billions and billions, you know, like Carl Sagan, billions and billions of dollars and rubles. And not to mention human life to get to the moon. And that's another thing that has always fascinated me. We spent God knows how much money in a race to get to the moon, starting with President Kennedy's, we're going to get there before the end of the decade and return a man safely. That was his pledge, and by God, we did it. But what was the rush? And then we did get there. We, the Americans, landed six times and basically said, to hell with it. We're not going back. Now, that never, ever made sense to me until years later.
And how come it came to make sense to you?
Well, I don't know if you're aware of it, but for many years I have conducted some very in-depth research on unexplained lunar phenomena. And a number of years ago, through a contact, I came into possession of some photographs that came from NASA that, in fact, to my eye, show irrefutable proof that somebody is on the moon and probably has been there for a very long time. Now, what do I mean by that? Indigenous moon people? No, of course not. But if any of these UFO cases in the last several thousand years were real, and I'm talking about real from the standpoint of extraterrestrial technology, does it make sense that these beings would travel from their planet to Earth every time they wanted to show up here? Of course not. So what would make sense? An ongoing lunar base, a site. And there are people over the years that I have collaborated with, one of them, Dr. Carl Wolf, who back in the early 60s was in the United States Air Force. He was credentialed, and by that I mean he had a top security clearance. And actually, it's a rather fascinating account that we ran years ago in UFO Magazine. Because of the clearance he had, he was basically an electronics technician. And whenever there were problems with classified technology that the Air Force was using, he would be called in, one of the people called in, to see if they could fix it. And it was during this period of time that we, the United States, was sending unmanned lunar probes to the moon in pursuit of the Apollo program. We wanted to find out what places would be good spots for the Apollo astronauts to ultimately land on. And he was called over there because at that period of time, this is how they were photographing the moon. The cameras would shoot strips of terrain, And then these strips were put together in a mosaic and beamed back to control. And then these photographs were printed out. And one of the printers had a glitch, and Carl was called over. And he went into this room with this one young, lonely Air Force technician that had been getting this information as it came down. I mean, there were a lot of people in there, but he was the only guy left when the thing broke. He had to stay in there and make sure everything was secure. Carl came in. The guy showed him what was wrong, and Carl was taking a look. He said, I could tell that there was something wrong with this guy. I knew better than to ask any questions, but he said, suddenly this young technician turned around and said, you know, we found the base up there. What? And the guy showed him a picture. I mean, he was so shocked, he had to share it with somebody. You know how it is if you have something extraordinary happen with you? At some point, you have to share it with somebody?
Yes.
This is what this young kid did. And Carl was so shocked that he couldn't say anything. And he said, I looked at that photograph, and I looked at these structures. They were obviously built by somebody. And I was so sure that this would be announced in the news in the next week or so that I waited every day for the announcement to be made. And, of course, it never was. So later, after we did get up there with the various Apollo missions, the word that I got through various sources was that we, the Americans, were basically told that you're not welcome here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was why the Apollo program was shut down. Now, NASA always maintained that the reason they stopped going to the moon was because the American public lost interest. What a crock. We lost interest in going to Vietnam by 1968, but they kept going until 1975. In 1972, with our last Apollo mission there, we still had a rocket ready to lift off. The astronauts were trained. All the equipment was ready to go, and it's still laying there on the pad, rusting away. So that tells me that something extraordinary caused this program to cease. And that, to my mind, could only mean that NASA and the U.S. government was aware of something else up on the moon.
Well, there were those rumors about the last couple of NASA flights to the moon, where at least one of the landings had occurred close to a supposed base that they could see from where they were, and they had to be very careful not to shoot pictures in that direction.
Well, here's something else that many people are not aware of, and as a matter of fact, I can recall back when I was doing my old radio show, UFOs Tonight, on the cable radio network. I had some people on, and we were discussing the Apollo missions, and I told the audience, I said, this is something that you're not aware of, but all the original astronauts that went up to the moon were armed. They carried firearms. And I got to tell you, I received a lot of flack about that until I proved it. They, in fact, were armed with .45 caliber pistols. Now, when NASA was queried on why did the astronauts go to the moon carrying sidearms, the NASA explanation was, well, you know, if when they were coming back from the moon, if they got lost coming back and they ended up in a jungle or something, we wanted to make sure that they could defend themselves. Well, the problem with that is that back in those days, American spacecraft were not making hard landings. They were landing in the ocean. And there's a hell of a lot of ocean out there. So the idea that they were afraid that they would end up in equatorial Africa just never struck me as ringing true.
Do we know whether they took those weapons down to the surface of the moon with them?
I don't know that, but I can only presume that they did.
And if so, why didn't they just leave them in the orbiter?
Yeah, you'd wonder about that.
Yeah, there would be no need to take them down to the surface of the moon if there was a need at all to carry them.
But they took them.
There have been a lot of intriguing stories, well, including, as you mentioned earlier on, the name Richard Hoagland. Hoagland maintained that there was some sort of tower on the far side of the moon.
Well, now, there is an interesting anecdote that I can lay on you, Earl. Back in the very early 90s, I had a guest on my radio program by the name of Jim Sylvan. Now, Jim had been very, very interested for many years in lunar phenomenon. And he had read a book that I then subsequently went out and got, George Leonard, Somebody Else is on the Moon. Now, Leonard, in this book, had a number of photographs that were very poorly reproduced in this paperback. But Jim went to NASA and got the copies of the actual photographs that Leonard had referenced. And then, darn him, he sent me a series of these. And when he did that, suddenly I sat up and really took notice. So I invited him to come on my program. And we had actually a couple of shows that were, in my opinion, just downright fascinating about some of the things in these photographs, some anecdotal stories that not only he, but that I had come across over the years, and why, if in fact they were, NASA would wish to hide this information. So, at the end of the show, we were on the phone after the broadcast went off the air, and Jim said, "Hey, Don," he said, "do you by chance know Dick Hoagland?" And I said, "Yes, I do. Why?" He said, "Well, I would love to get in touch with Hoagland. I think he has done some great work on the Cydonia question, the face on Mars, and I would like to send Hoagland some of these photographs." So I said, "Sure, I can give you his address and phone number." So I did. Well, about 6 months later, roughly 6 months, Dick Hoagland suddenly discovered lunar phenomena.
Ah.
And I called Jim up and I said, "Hey, apparently, I guess you got through to him, huh?" And he said, "Well," he said, "I sent him the information and I told him I'd like to talk to him and blah, blah, blah." He said, "But damn, I never heard a word from him." And I said, "Well, guess what? Dick has suddenly discovered lunar phenomena." And unfortunately, this seems to be a criticism that Hoagland has come under from a number of people over the years, the last, well, 30 years, in a number of different venues, that he does not often credit where he gets a lot of his information from.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I personally cannot state that from my own experience. As you will see in my paper, I received a call from Hoagland back in the early 90s when he was working with Professor Stan McDaniel. And they were attempting to put pressure on NASA. This is before the Mars Observer. To put pressure on NASA to go back and re-photograph the Cydonia region and answer once and for all, ha-ha, whether there was, in fact, a face in Cydonia.
Mm-hmm.
Hoagland said, "The reason I'm calling you," he said, "McDaniel and I had heard that back in the early 60s, I'm not quite sure when, but when NASA was brand new, that they had contracted out for a position paper from some think tank. And would you check and see if you could help in locating this thing for us?"
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did. And I found out it was from the Brookings Institute. And I came up with the name and a lot of information surrounding it, and Hoagland, in fact, credited me for that. He's got it on his website in the section about the Brookings Institute.
There was a study commissioned by NASA of a group of prestigious Americans from all walks of life, academia, politics, law, economics, etc. It is called Proposed Studies on the Implications of Peaceful Space Activities for Human Affairs. It was prepared by the Brookings Institution in Washington as a report to NASA and subsequently was communicated on April 18, 1961 by NASA to the U.S. Congress Committee on Science and Astronautics of the House of Representatives of the 87th Congress First Session. What's important about the Brookings report is what you read on page 215. There is the beginnings of an interesting discussion titled Implications of a Discovery of Extraterrestrial Life. It says, anthropological files contain many examples of societies sure of their place in the universe which have disintegrated when they had to associate with previously unfamiliar societies espousing different ideas and different life ways. Others that survived such an experience usually did so by paying the price of changes in values and attitudes and behavior. What the document was warning was that if NASA were to discover extraterrestrials or even their artifacts, the social consequences conceivably could lead to the, quote, disintegration of civilization. And what you have to ask, I had to ask myself over and over and over again, Hoagland, are you crazy? How could anyone have missed this?
So I can't grouse about his running with that information, but other people can, and one of them was Jim Sylvan, who felt that he had sent this information, and Dick never even got back to him about it. So I don't know, Earl.
In my time, I've heard similar stories. I've only ever talked to him on the program, read his website, his blog, and, well, he made some claims about being involved with the disc, the LP, the long-playing record that was sent into space aboard one of the Pioneers, I think it was.
Yeah, Pioneer 10, mm-hmm. along with Carl Sagan. He has claimed that he was one of the people responsible for the plaque.
I remember the Saturday Night Live bit about that was Chevy Chase came up in the news segment and said, well, we've received a response to the gold record that was on the side of the Pioneer that was fired into space about 6 months ago. And the response reads, send more Chuck Berry.
Yeah, incidentally, I was just checking my database here, the Brookings Report. What was really remarkable in this report, remember, this was published and given to NASA in 61. Many people will not be aware of this because there's always been a NASA in their lifetime. But prior to the late 50s, when President Dwight Eisenhower created NASA, all of our space pursuits were being carried out by our various military services. And oftentimes they were working at cross purposes. After the 57 launch of Sputnik, American science and technology took a terrific black eye that the Russians beat us into space. So Eisenhower came to the correct conclusion. The only way to go about this was to have a separate space agency. Ergo, NASA was created. Now, initially, Earl, NASA was just a bunch of guys sitting around a rented table in a rented office after NASA was created, and they were talking among themselves and saying, okay, here we are, now what? Well, they contracted to Brookings. Now, Brookings had some of the top intellectual talent in the United States, if not the world at that time. And they created this report. And one of their conclusions was, and this is what is so shocking to people today to look at this, that it followed the recommendations of what happens, not if, Earl, but when extraterrestrial artifacts or life is discovered in the solar system sometime within the next 20 years. Now, we're talking 1961. So that would put 20 years would be what? 1981.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do? Because two groups of people are going to be adversely affected. And those groups of people will be scientists and engineers, because they will be absolutely disillusioned with their limited knowledge when they encounter ET technology, and religious fundamentalists, which suddenly will have their closed little parochial view of the universe shattered. So, what do we do? Now, this is the important thing. What do we do? Do we release this information, or do we conceal this information? And I think the facts would seem to suggest that they came to the conclusion that we must conceal the information.
Yeah. But
that's my take on it.
Yes, and mine too, and Dave for lots. I mean, there's a lot of us all feel the same way, that NASA has been indeed suppressing knowledge of extraterrestrial beings, which would be the reason for all the stupid answers that they have given to all of the anomalous footage, as mentioned earlier in this program.
Absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm. So why are you leaving, Don, when you have gotten off on all the discoveries and research that you have done over the last 20 years?
Quite frankly, in my opinion, and it's been a long time coming, that the level of research conducted has fallen to almost zero. Today, the inmates are running the asylum. And what do I mean by that? that the believers, with some of their truly fuzzy, illogical thinking, has just absolutely destroyed this field for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as an example, my wife began UFO Magazine back in 1986. She, along with her partner at that time, Sherry Stark, began the magazine. My wife was a journalism graduate who, incidentally, always had an interest in this subject. And her business partner, Sherry, was in commercial editing and that type of thing. And they came to the conclusion, you know what, there is no publication out there that takes a real journalistic look at this unreported subject. So they began UFO Magazine. About 2 years later, I began writing for the magazine, and I was utilizing my investigative background and investigative techniques to report on stories. And granted, some of these stories at first blush will really seem to be out there, but we were absolutely trying to report the facts as we found them. And that included showing people that were obviously hoaxing cases or making outlandish claims with not a shred of proof. We reported on that. And over the years, I did a number of major exposés on people in the field that were really, in my opinion, ruining it for everybody. But as time went on, in 1997, we were forced, because of money, to take some business partners in, and they were in the entertainment business. And these folks did not really have a clue on anything having to do with this subject. It was strictly a money-making thing. And 5 years later, Vicki and I ended up getting rights to the magazine back, but we had to take partners, which were Bill Burns and his wife, Nancy. Now, Bill, as many will know, is the co-author, along with Phil Corso, of a major blockbuster book on the UFO subject, The Day After Roswell. Now, regardless of whether you think Corso was real or not, the fact of the matter is Corso himself was real. He had the credentials, he had the rank, he had the top security clearances, and it's often like people will argue with me about somebody else in the field that I have high regard for, Zachariah Sitchin. Sitchin often has been criticized for his, what some folks feel, his outlandish theories are. But Zacharias Sitchin has never claimed to be more than an ancient language linguist. He is one of only a couple of hundred people alive in the world that can translate, read, and decipher ancient Sumerian, the very first recorded language that we know of, going back over 6,000 years. Now, what Sitchin has done is simply reported what the ancient Sumerians were saying, and he formulated a hypothesis that Earth was, in fact, visited by superior beings a very long time ago who tinkered with the human race. Now, that's it in a nutshell. Corso claimed that he discovered that extraterrestrials were tinkering with a lot of things, and that in certain covert offices within the American military, there was genuine fear in the late 50s, early 60s, that this extraterrestrial presence was possibly hostile, and that things had to be done in order to protect against that. So that's Corso in a nutshell. Now, Bill Burns helped Phil get that thing written, but Bill is an academic, former college professor, and he's a writer. And I might add, Bill Burns is an excellent writer. Mm-hmm. But the difference is, I am a researcher, investigator. And as Bill and his wife became more and more and more involved in UFO magazine, they began indiscriminately allowing points of view from all across the field into the magazine.
Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing, Don?
In my opinion, and this is, I'm only strictly speaking from the standpoint of factual reporting, there are certainly all points of view. But if one is stressing to be the publication of record, one must be willing to separate the wheat from the chaff. And a case that I point to most recently involved one columnist was writing a long diatribe about the quote-unquote Dulce Base shootout circa 1979. Now, this is a bit of crapola. Let me rephrase that. It's a bit of crapola that surfaced years ago in the Paul Benowitz-John Lear mishmash that came out that was proven definitively to be, well, at best, wishful thinking, at worst, outright disinformation. But this is presented uncritically, with no examination, and apparently no knowledge that it was disinformation from almost 20 years ago. When people like myself, who have a firm foundation in the history of this subject, reads that, you lose all credibility.
What I don't understand is having people like yourself and Vicky around and then being part of the editorial process, why would Bill and Nancy Burns not talk to either of you and say, hey, what do you think about this?
Bill has the opinion that everybody should have a say, and then let the reading audience decide. Now, I most strenuously object to that. It's, you know, there is a very vocal minority out there that believe that the Apollo program was a government disinformation campaign that was actually filmed on a soundstage.
In Sudbury, Ontario, yes.
Yeah, are we going to let these morons into the magazine spouting that nonsense?
Of course not.
Well, not as long as I had something to say with it. But I just, over the years, it just became almost an exercise in futility. I'll give you an example. Now, Earl, you, for years, have done a hell of a job maintaining the UFO update list. And over the years, I haven't contributed tons to the UFO update list, but periodically I would go up. If I had something I thought was of interest, I would leave a message, a note, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And over the years, a number of my exposés that I did, somebody would put them up on the list, or even I would.
Yes.
And one of them concerned a guy in the field that I had mentioned somewhat earlier in this interview, by the name of Guy Kirkwood. Now, this guy is an out-and-out BS artist. BS. And I think anybody with an ounce or a modicum of gray matter will take a look at the facts and come to the same conclusion. He was never in the Air Force. He never presented DD-214s. So that means, in fact, he was not an Air Force intercept pilot back in the 50s chasing UFOs to photograph them for the Air Force. He was not a commercial airline pilot. No record of him. And that's just a small part of the evidence. So I did this expose, and one day, lo and behold, up there, I saw a posting from one of the occasional list posters by the name of Bill Hamilton. Now, Hamilton has been a UFO investigator going back many, many moons. As a matter of fact, back circa 1990, 91, there used to be a woman here in the area by the name of Penny Harper that had a monthly get-together for UFO folks called the UFO Forum, and I even spoke down there a couple of times. And I can remember when the channeling craze was really picking up some momentum, I even saw Hamilton down there trying to channel. I'm just throwing that out as an aside. So anyway, in this note that he puts up there, he said that in my expose, I got a lot of facts wrong. So, being what I consider to be a conscientious researcher, investigator, I queried him on the UFO updates list. And I had to do it several times before he finally answered me. And finally he said, well, you got his middle name wrong. And that's it?
Yeah.
I got his middle name wrong. I said, well, to begin with a guy that has that many names, how the hell would you know initially? But I didn't get his middle name wrong. There is an example that, in my opinion, is somebody that is a believer. He wants to believe. And no matter how many times the facts jump up and bite him on the posterior, he's going to believe. Do not confuse me with facts. My mind is made up.
Seems to me that of late Bill Hamilton has also been involved with the promulgation of Project Serpo.
Project Serpo, Dan Burrish. Now there's another BS artist, somebody that has been thoroughly discredited. I did some work on that. Of course, George Knapp, the television investigative journalist from KLAS-TV, Channel 8, Las Vegas, I've had a lot of collaboration with Knapp on this case because he was very deeply involved. That's what I'm saying. We're dealing with a believer. Now, the Project Serpo stuff, what a crock of wishful thinking and ozone layer sniffing. Not a shred of proof. Of course, now that's pretty much evaporated, you realize.
Yes.
Even the Serpo website that had been up disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
But for a long period of time, a lot of people really thought there might be something there. And once again, don't confuse me with facts. My mind is made up. I want to believe that, yes, we are in contact with E.T., and we've been to his planet, and he's coming here. And the problem is, this is the kind of thinking that will get you in trouble because there are unscrupulous people out there, and perhaps there are even people within government that are floating these stories just to see where they'll go.
And maybe even deliberately floating them just to cloud the issue.
Exactly. You could not be more correct.
Divide and conquer, I think, is the expression that applies.
Now, come on, Earl. Who would really have to work to divide and conquer this mishmash of so-called research? I mean, they've done a hell of a job dividing and conquering themselves.
But the seeds were planted, what, 20, 30 years ago? With all kinds of nonsense that was being put out there. Look at Bill Cooper. Behold a Pale Horse. When I first got involved in this field, I spent 6 months, 9 months just reading the BBS Fido UFO and John.
Well, then you will remember my initial expose on Cooper.
Yes, absolutely. But the number of people who would come to MUFON Ontario meetings carrying printouts of Bill Cooper garbage and say, look what I found. Oh, this is so hot and so real. Not.
Yeah. I really believe that on his end, at least initially, was a money-making scam. Now, the biggest thing that Cooper really hawked for a long time was the JFK tape, the poorly done Zapruder film that he stole and used to bilk probably thousands of people out of $25 and $35 a copy. Now, this tape originally, and you see, I was right there when all this happened, and I talk about it in my paper, 20 Years in the UFO Fog. When I first came across MJ-12 and John Lear's paper, I got in touch with Lear. I called him up and spent a couple hours on the phone with him. And a week or so later, he sent me a big, huge package of his material that he was sending out to support his initial hypothesis. Well, later on, I ended up, when I heard about this JFK assassination thing, I flew down to Las Vegas, and I met with Lear, and I saw this tape that he had, and yes, with this particular tape, for just a brief second, it really does look like the driver turns around with a gun just as Kennedy is shot. However, when I asked him, where did you get this tape, he was real coy about it. I later found out and located the guy that originally put it together, a fellow by the name of Lars Hansen. Now, Hansen, this is a rather unusual story in itself. Lars was, in fact, a longtime conspiracist, JFK researcher, and the reason he initially got in touch with John Lear, he was looking for somebody to finance his research into the JFK assassination. And he thought that Lear, being the son of William Lear, of Lear Jet fame and Lear Sigler Corporation, was wealthy. He was not aware at the time that Bill Lear had disowned his son, John. So John was not privy to any of the millions and millions of dollars that his dad left when his dad passed away. But John, at that time, God only knows why, had discovered UFOs. He told me that it was after he found out about the Bentwaters case that took place in the UK in 1980 that he really became interested. But who knows? John was using this tape in his presentation, and there were a lot of people that were really bothered by what they thought they were seeing. Now, when I met Lars Hansen, I got to know him. I found out that he and two other guys had a poor copy of the Zapruder film. And one of his cohorts was working on the theory that the driver or the other Secret Service agent had to be involved in this assassination. And they had washed all the color out of the Zapruder film in an attempt to enhance the contrasts. And, of course, now we're talking 1963. And what did men use on their hair in 1963? Boy, and talk about a trivia question.
Brill cream.
Brill cream! And there was a flash of light on the head of this Secret Service agent, and for a brief second, you see what looks like a gun. Now, Lear and Hansen initially were claiming that this was a .45 automatic, and the .45 is what actually made the fatal headshot on JFK. Now, as I state in my paper, and I have that frame in question up there, I have extensive experience with weapons, not only from the military, but when I was a police officer. A 45 automatic pistol has tremendous muzzle flash, okay? There's no mistaking a 45 when it goes off. And there was no evidence, none, of muzzle flash in this picture. Now, we're talking about a distance of only a foot or so, had that actually have happened, the driver shooting JFK. And my God, Earl, there were hundreds of people all around there. Do you really think that the quote-unquote secret government could have kept that secret if the driver had actually shot JFK? There were too many people there to silence.
Yes, yes.
But at any rate, Lear was running with this. Then he had sent a copy of this to Cooper. And Cooper immediately appropriated it into his dog and pony show. And he began giving public lectures. One of the most famous was here at Hollywood High School. And Hansen, by this time, had even gone to Cooper and said, look, that's my video. You have no right to it. I don't authorize you to use this in your lecture or sell it. But, of course, Cooper, being the unscrupulous scumbag that he was, did. And he was selling this thing for $25 and $35 a piece. Now, you talk about chutzpah. During this whole tape, there was narration on it by Lars Hansen. Cooper sent it off to Japan, had the film re-colorized, the narration cut, and then at these dog and pony shows, he would narrate it. So this guy was just a real unscrupulous scumbag. He was, I'm convinced, in it initially simply for the money. And he probably made a hell of a lot of money from it.
It's unfortunate because he's another one who clouded the water.
Yeah, and there's still what's really disturbing to me, there are still people out there that think that this guy was onto something.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I still run into people who absolutely refuse to believe that the guy was a shyster.
And that's the good thing about him, the shyster part.
Yes. Undoubtedly. Can I throw a couple of names at you, Don Ecker, for some comment?
Sure.
Stanton Friedman.
Stan has done some really great work over the years in the past, but in my opinion, he today is basically a one-trick pony. And what do I mean by that?
Flying saucers are real.
Yeah, flying saucers are real, and here's my bundle of papers with everything blacked out. Okay, been there, done that. What's happening, for example, on the moon? What's happening with Mars? What's happening right now in the skies above Mexico City? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Kevin Randall had a very interesting remark last week up on UFO Updates when he announced that I basically was getting out of the field, and that was about the infighting and the petty squabbles, the petty jealousies, etc., that infest UFO research among the more credible researchers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, I agree with what Randall had to say there, but he pointed out that in his first book on Roswell, he had, in his acknowledgments, mentioned two people, Bob Hastings and Stan Friedman, and that after the book was published, Stan contacted him and wanted to know why Bob Hastings had at least one line more in the acknowledgments than he did. Now, I have no reason to ever question the veracity of anything that Randall has ever told me, and I have to wonder what makes a guy call up and complain because somebody else got one line more in the acknowledgments than he did.
I don't know, but Stan is certainly a cut above the average nuclear physicist, I think.
Well, he's one of the few people that, from his background, has been willing to take on the UFO thing. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes.
But, you know, hey, Stan hasn't done any nuclear research in, what, 40 years?
Yep. Let's throw Bruce Maccabee at you, Don.
Okay, Bruce. Now, he's one of the people that initially when I first got involved in the field, I called up, I talked to. But Bruce is also somebody that I broke the story in UFO Magazine and on my radio show that he was going over to brief people at CIA. And he was doing it covertly. He was, at the time, chairman of the Fund for UFO Research, an organization that has, among other people, Dick Hall in it. And as a result, when this story broke, Bruce was removed from the chairmanship. Now, we got to remember back to the summer of 1989, the Mutual UFO Network Symposium in Las Vegas, Nevada, which, incidentally, at the time, John Lear was the chairman of the state for MUFON. And Bill Moore came out and admitted that he had worked hand in glove with quote-unquote military intelligence and also disinformed UFO researchers at the behest of these intelligence people. Now, that was comparable to shooting yourself in the head. Okay, Moore, from that point forward, was finished in UFO research. But Bruce McAbee is still out there. On the face of it, perhaps that was innocuous. But we've got to ask ourselves, what was he briefing them on? Personalities in the field? Certain cases? What? And then I come back to STS-48. I have a rather interesting anecdote about Bruce in that paper. When I first received that videotape from a UFO researcher back in Maryland by the name of Don Ratch, who had called me up, told me about this unbelievable sequence of events that he got that was downlinked from the shuttle video to a small cable TV station where he lived. He said, "Man, I'm telling you, you've never seen anything like this." So he sent it out to me. Well, when I received it, it just so happened Vicki and I got a call from Bruce McAbee. Bruce was at some scientific conference here in California, and he said, "Well, if you guys are available, I'd like to come over and catch up with you." And we said, "Sure." So he came over to our house, and in the interim, I had already invited a couple of other folks to view this tape. So everybody's sitting in my living room. I pop this in my VCR. We start watching this sequence of events, STS-48, and our mouths were down around our ankles. Couldn't believe it. This was unbelievable. Not only is this what appears to be a genuine UFO, there is a genuine shooting at it, by all appearances. And then, most people have never seen what else is on that tape. There's a lot of it. But we sat there, we watched this whole thing, and McAbee is sitting there not saying a word. As I later found out, this was astounding, because already McAbee was not only aware of this, but he and Vince DiPietro had, among other things, taken this to several congressional folks in an attempt to get congressional interest into this amazing UFO encounter. In other words, McAbee knew all about it. He sat there, he never said a word to us. Now, I got to tell you, from the standpoint of just being an ex-detective, that struck me as weird. So I wonder what kind of file they have on me at CIA.
And Armin Victorian, I don't know if you recall that name. Many years ago now, I guess 10 years ago, had accused McAbee of interfering when he, Victorian, had written to the Naval's Secret Intelligence, whatever they are, whose acronym and name I can't remember, accused McAbee of interfering because he got a response, an anonymous response, on the same paper stock, same second page, no letterhead, typed on a machine that was identical to the response that he got from that department on official letterhead.
Well, you know, let's face it now, Armin Victorian was no gem.
No, he wasn't, but he did dig out some interesting things despite.
That guy used to call me frequently from the UK, and Of course, he never thought to mention to me that he was an orchid thief. Done a little jail time there, yes. Smuggling orchids.
Yeah.
But, you know, Victorian, I got to be up front. When, mm-hmm. Of course, you know, you're dragging up some names. My God, I hadn't thought of him in many moons.
Yes.
But I was never comfortable talking to that guy. You know, one thing, being a cop, you really get a sense of people when you first talk to them. You know whether you're comfortable with them or not.
Yeah.
And Armin was one of those guys I never felt comfortable talking to. There was always, in my opinion, some agenda he was working on that he wasn't letting out to the rest of the world.
But at the same time, and just to come back to Bruce Maccabee again, I wonder why he would have sat in front of a freeze frame of a so-called landed UFO in Carp, Ontario, and declared the freeze frame to be the most astounding image of a landed UFO he'd ever seen, when this is now a photo analyst talking with some rudimentary tools that we had back in those days. We were able to see that it was a pickup truck with strobe lights on it and traffic flares around it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that was a case that I labeled, in my opinion, a hoax from day one.
Oh, yes, yes.
And that was something that I had written about on UFO Updates. As a matter of fact, if you go back into the archives, you'll probably find my original note about it, that I had received a sheaf of papers in an unmarked, no return address envelope, and in there, and if I am recalling now, Earl, it was three-star general, supposedly...
I mean, it was rank amateurish documentation, basically.
Yeah.
Yes.
But here's the other thing. Now, Bruce, a naval optical physicist, he is a credentialed PhD, working basically at the behest of the U.S. government. But he's one of the most visible UFO researchers. Now, how many other people in government with a high-profile job like that is allowed to go out and bounce around the UFO subject?
Well, I don't know, but why is he allowed to?
That's my question.
Mm-hmm.
He has apparently never suffered for a UFO interest. Yet I have known many people that have suffered because of their UFO interest. But as Bill Moore told me, Bruce is one hell of a pianist. He can
yes.
really tickle the ivory.
Yes, and he frequently does at major UFO conferences. You know, it's closing time when Maccabee sits down at the piano, apparently. Are you going to turn this paper of yours, 20 Years in the UFO Fog, or your foray into the wonderful, wacky world of UFOs, a thumbnail historical sketch of the UFO field, circa 1987 to 2007? This smacks. I mean, it feels like the outline of a book.
Well,
or two.
Are you aware that I'm a published fiction novelist?
No,
I wrote a couple of years ago a novel. It's available up on Amazon. It's called Past Sins, a novel of supernatural horror. And I've gotten actually some quite good reviews on it. And I've been dilly-dallying with the sequel. As one of the reviewers said, this is a novel that not only screams for, but begs for a sequel. And I've been working off and on this sequel. If I ever do decide to turn this paper into a book, well, I got to be honest, it's not going to be anytime soon. And by then, everybody will have forgotten who the hell I am, so they won't care anyway.
Oh, I doubt that very much. I think you've left too much of a mark. Your name, your articles, your reviews, your research is all over the web and will continue to pop up into time.
Let me do a shameless plug. If you like scary, and I mean genuinely scary, then check out Past Sins, a novel of supernatural horror, which is up on Amazon. author Don Ecker, and hey, if I could sell a book or two, I'd love it.
Okay, well, I'll put a link to that up in the program listing too. So what's to become of yourself and Dwight Schultz as far as the Dark Matters program is concerned?
Well, Dwight, he's doing his own web broadcast. It's called Howling Mad Radio. Of course, that's a takeoff on his character from the A-Team, Howling Mad Murdoch. Back in the 80s, when he was starring along with George Peppard, Mr. T, Dirk Benedict, but he's doing Howling Mad Radio. I'm occasionally doing Dark Matters Radio. Now, I've had people ask me, well, Ecker, you said you left the UFO field, but yet I hear broadcast with you and Kevin Randall, you and George Knapp, you and Bob Kiviat. Who are you kidding? Well, the fact is, yeah, I have left UFO research. But this is still a subject that interests me. Mm-hmm. Now, I hit a lot of different wacky topics in the broadcast. Like, I have one coming up here pretty soon where I'm going to be doing a broadcast with a producer of a new documentary that's going to be released later this year called Bloodline on the Mary Magdalene so-called conspiracy. So we hit a lot of different things, but yeah. If I have something that piques my interest, oh yeah, I'll still do a broadcast on it. The thing of it is, I don't have to be nearly as nice, though, on the air as I do in print. So.
Where can people find Dark Matters? Is it darkmatters.com?
Darkmattersradio.com.
Darkmattersradio.com. And you archive there as well.
It's all up there. As a matter of fact, we are part of something called the Patriot Radio Brigade Network, and Dwight is up there, Lori Roth is up there, I'm up there, the guy that produces my show, Land Lamp Fear, is up there. There's a number of folks, and it's taking all across the spectrum, everything from Dark Matters to Dwight's Howling Mad Radio to, you'd have to go up and take a look.
Yeah, I will, and I'm sure the listener will, too. I'm glad you're not pulling out completely, Don Ecker. It will be a great shame, and I'm sure that something will come along in the next couple of years or so that will just haul your ass back in here again.
Well, I'll tell you what. Don't hold your breath.
You know, I'm getting too old to hold my breath.
No. I don't know if you will totally understand this, but when I'm done with something, that's it. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
For 20 years, Earl, I've really beat my head on this subject, trying to make a difference. And I honestly, and this is something I think most people that have been in the field any length of time, you included, will be the first to admit, I feel like I know less today than I did when I started in 1987.
Yes, I have more questions now than when I started out because I didn't know much back then, but with the accumulated small amount of knowledge that I have, there are way more questions to be answered than I've had the satisfaction of getting.
Well, you got to go where your heart takes you, my friend.
Well, that's where I am at the moment. There have been a couple of times, Don, when I haven't wanted to continue. Exactly as you've done, throw up my hands in disgust and say, what is the matter with you people? Spend the time on the new evidence. Stop rehashing the old stuff. There's nothing else to be gleaned from it.
Well, once again, you see, this is the difference between, well, for example, you and I and many people in this field. This was what I did for 20 years. This was not a hobby. This was not my sideshow. This is what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, this is simply an area of interest. It's a hobby. It's something that they do when they come home from work. Now, those very same people will not understand when I pull my hair out in exasperation, screaming, but, you know, the guy is a liar. Why would you? Well, yeah, but here's what he said there. And it's just after a while, it's like, hey, folks, I just can't do this anymore.
I understand completely, Don. And I want to thank you for that. I'm glad that you took the time with us. And perhaps, who knows, don't hold your breath, Errol. Who knows that perhaps one or two people who are hearing this, wherever they are, will pay attention and say, geez, you know, that Don Ecker guy is right. There's a lot of crap out there, and I've been buying into it.
Well, we can only hope. And if that happens, then I guess maybe a part of those 20 years will have been worth it.
When are you going to digitize all your programs and make them available for a minor subscription?
Are you talking about my old radio show?
Yes, with the cable radio network.
Well, them too, yeah. As a matter of fact, well, you know, I've had 5 different radio shows. All my old UFOs Tonight tapes, I have all those. That's something that I have planned to digitize. Unfortunately, most of my Liberty Works radio shows, which I called Strange Days back in the late 90s, I don't have.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Dark Matter shows that I did with Dwight, they are all digitized. And of course, the ones that I'm doing now are digitized. You know, it's just been a case of, I don't know if my wife would say it's laziness, but I've just had so many irons in the fire that I haven't really gotten to it yet.
I'm sitting here looking at 1,000 cassettes of Strange Days Indeed going back to 98, and they all have to be digitized. And I'm looking at that going, oh my God, I just don't have the time, even with 2 tape decks and 2 other computers working on the side. It's a staggering amount of work.
Well, you know, when I think of some of the people that I interviewed over the years, people like Congressman Steve Schiff from New Mexico, who of course is now dead, Carl Flock, who is dead, Phil Klass. You know, I don't know how many people are aware that I caused Phil to blow up on my UFOs Tonight show in January of 95, screaming bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. But these are, I guess they are actually historical recordings.
And damn good quality, too, I bet. That would digitize perfectly, and you'd hear Klass's sharp intake of breath as he got progressively more pissed with you.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Memories, huh?
Thank you, Barbara Streisand. I know you have good things outside of ufology that you are involved with, Veterans Affairs and taking care of the vets. And I know that they appreciate it as much as many people have appreciated your efforts in this field over the last 20 years.
Well, thank you, Earl. It's been fun, I guess, going over some of this. Actually, though, you know, we could sit here and do this for a week solid.
Yeah, and still wouldn't cover everything.
Yeah.
Don, I wish you well. I'm sure that we will talk again at some point in the future. Talk to you again, Don. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Earl.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks to Don Ecker and Dave Frelott for making this program what it is this week. Next week, space correspondent Michael J. Woods, Kevin Randall, and Alfred Lemberg. And if you haven't done so already, go to this week's program listing and download Don Ecker's paper. Thanks for listening and subscribing. Till next week.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.